Welcome, everyone, to the Fall 2020 Dean's Lecture Series. For those of you who may not know, I'm Walter Sterling, the Dean of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm so glad you all can join us today. And before I introduce him, I just want to say I'm very grateful to Mr. Stickney, as with our other lectures this fall, for taking the plunge and being willing to share their thoughts and conversation with us through this platform, which in some ways allows some of us to connect maybe even better than we might have had we been in person. We expect to go for about an hour with the lecture, then we'll take a brief break, just 2-3 minutes, and then we'll have a question period. You'll be able to either write questions or raise your hand and have your microphone turned on once we get to that stage. And if we have any technical difficulties, we'll try to resolve them quickly. So far, we've had pretty good luck with this. We have a tradition at the college of not introducing our own, but I've felt consistently the need to violate that in this space. It just seems right not to give my colleagues the introduction they deserve, but to at least acknowledge them. And it is my pleasure to welcome my friend and colleague and teacher, Kerry Stickney. Mr. Stickney is a graduate of the college, class of 1975, and has been a tutor and a member of the faculty since 1980, and is now tutor emeritus. If we do it at St. John's, Mr. Stickney has done it and done it well. Among many other accomplishments, he's brought a great deal of joy and life to our campus, especially in recent years, through informal music at lunchtime with an ever-changing band. And I know many of our students and alumni recognize him from that setting. He's given many lectures over the years on the widest range of topics. And one thing I'd say about Mr. Stickney, when I think about him, I think about somebody who always wants to articulate what is best and most important about the college. And it's by doing so that we're made better. So I continue to be extremely grateful for his voice and what he has to say and what he cares about at St. John's. And I think with that, Mr. Stickney, I'll invite you to take the microphone and Mr. Stickney is lecturing today on the Meno. I believe the title that you settled on was Incommensurability, Meno, and the Diagonal.
So, that's right.
Mr. Stickney.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a great honor and pleasure to be here with a chance to address those members of the college who are with us now, and some hope that others may get a chance to see this later as a recording, or I'm happy to send the text, or the dean's office can send the text of this lecture. I especially had this year's freshman in mind as I was writing it, and I thought I would write something that might be especially interesting to them when they had read the Meno and finished book one of Euclid. But I realized as I wrote it that I was also writing a kind of preface for the juniors when they come to study Dedekind in the spring of their junior year, and maybe a look back for the seniors who might have felt often Dedekind is squeezed into the very end of junior math, and sometimes one wishes one had a little more time to think about it. So it's for everyone. I dedicate it to all the students and faculty and alumni, board members of both campuses that I have had the great good fortune to learn with over the years. St. John's has been my life, and it has been a very good life. And I'm very, very pleased to be able to thank all the people who have meant so much to me. My closest family counts among those who have been also teachers, faculty, alumni, students that I have learned with, and I especially thank Mr. Robert Abbott, an Annapolis tutor currently on sabbatical, who has proofread this lecture and helped me with it. All right. On incommensurability. This is an attempt to think about a question that is considered settled. And so I must warn you that I may seem to be wasting our time. Like other such ventures you may encounter at St. John's, it is less concerned with what we might be said to know, either these days or at any time, and more interested in how we think we know it. You and I are in the enviable position of not having to worry what each other will think if you just virtually slip out of this virtual hall. You are putting up with a good bit already in these odd times, and if what is on your screen late on a Wednesday afternoon on this beautiful autumn day is not at least moderately absorbing, then feel free to do something else. You will not hurt my feelings. Incommensurability, in its most general sense, describes the relation of two or more measurable things that have no common measure. We might say that the length of a road and the loudness of a shout have no common measure. The road is not twice as long as the shout is loud, or any other multiple or fraction of the shout's loudness either, though both length and loudness can be measured. Must the two things, road length and shout volume, have some common measure in order that we be aware of them both at all? Do we have to be able to measure a thing to know it is there? We commonly suppose that the existence of things is found in the evidence of our senses. If I can see the road or hear the shout, then it is there. Seeing and hearing do not have to be the same thing in order to testify to the presence of the things we see and hear. Nobody is meanwhile scandalized that many things have some kind of relation of incommensurability to one another. The situation grows more interesting if two things that could easily be imagined to have a common measure can be shown to have none. Suppose I could show you two straight lines that cannot possibly have a common measure. They would not be lines in pencil lead or chalk, but if those are the only kinds of lines you will accept, you had better virtually slip out now. No matter how small the equal pieces may be that I can divide one line into, I would show that no such piece would ever fit a whole number of times into the other line. It seems unimaginable that this should be so. It may be even harder to imagine than the possibility, shall I call it the opposite possibility, raised in the Meno, that all human excellence could be grasped as a simple unity. Let us begin with what measuring is. It seems to be a laying out of something next to something else in order to tell which one is more in some way and which less. We can easily see who is taller when two stand side by side, but how do we know who will make a better ruler? Creon in Sophocles' Antigone knows that he is being measured by the hard times he must rule in, but he does not imagine that it might be in yielding to Antigone that he would show his worthiness to rule. To what must I show myself adequate, cries Creon, or more literally, what is it? To what kind of happenstance do I arrive commensurable? The Greek word translated by commensurable here, symmetros, means sharing a measure with. Symmetric things have their parts in proportion to each other. Things are in balance and they hold together by having a common measure. Creon seems worried that there may be situations he cannot rule. He's not wrong to worry. Rulers need not only strength, but understanding. The human soul itself could turn out to contain parts that share no common measure. Do our powerful fears and desires have any common language with our cautious reasonings at all? To find oneself incapable of judging a situation for want of a proper measure is perhaps not an uncommon fear. It might be like an anxiety dream in which you have to take an exam in a language you don't speak. Anxious democracies often invoke the importance of the things we all have in common, our commensurability. We say that is our strength, what unites us. But those things must be so often invoked because of the strength of what divides us. Each of us is a unique self. Some of the things we want most cannot be shared. We find ourselves sometimes desperately wishing a very particular someone could see something in us that is to be found in nobody else. Sometimes we boast of how well we know that no one else can die for us. It seems to make not only our deaths, but our whole lives look for a moment like inalienable property, and to give us permission to do whatever we want with every precarious moment we are alive. Some who dispute this view believe that someone else, God in fact, has died in our place, and that the death of God overcomes the incommensurability of divine and human. But that is at the very least another lecture. Socrates reminds us early in his conversation with Meno that Meno's father was a friend of Xerxes, the great king of all Persia. And he means us to glimpse Meno's inner Xerxes and our own. Those who unashamedly take Xerxes as a measure in their drive for greatness must refuse to be run-of-the-mill examples of the generically human. Sophocles minces no words in titling his paradigmatic tragedy Oedipus the Tyrant. We each have something in us that wants to be a god, utterly unconstrained. Whether that leads to philosophy or tyranny or eternal salvation is not clear. Each looks incommensurable with our daily life. Incommensurability and the golden section. My wonder at the incommensurable was rekindled a few years ago in a freshman mathematics tutorial when we came to Euclid's proposition 11 of book 2, which shows how to divide a line so that the rectangle formed by the whole line and the smaller piece of the division will equal the square on the larger piece. The more famous example is already hiding in 147, the Pythagorean theorem. In neither proposition does Euclid say anything explicit about the topic, but it somehow came to mind for me in book 2. When we have learned how to make the division of the line in proposition 11, we may wonder, even if we do not recognize what we can now do as dividing a line in the so-called golden section, is there a numerical relation between the two pieces into which we know how to divide the given line? That is, could they be measured by some common unit? And would there thus be a fixed numerical relation between the two pieces? Are there then two numbers whose relation to each other names a specific kind of beauty? Maybe so. A specific ratio of beauty may not be as silly as it sounds. Perhaps the example of maximum commensurability, instantly recognizable in its unsurpassed simplicity, is the ratio of the double. Aristotle is not afraid to say that the sound of the octave is the embodiment of a 2-to-1 ratio, and that it is not only agreeable but beautiful. Why should we like the relation produced by doubling? This is the sort of question that may conceal more depth than we think. What does it mean that beauty could be a kind of order? The two sets of vibrations that coincide every second beat, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, oh, hundreds of times per second, are a kind of march or two-step that we hear as two pitches, a perfect mingling and repetition of same and slightly other. We may not even know there is more than one pitch involved. They blend so well. What is it that makes order beautiful? I am dying, Egypt. Dying, says Mark Antony to Cleopatra in Shakespeare's play, calling her Egypt in a rhetorical figure that lets us see her as the representative of the whole nation she rules, as if Antony could speak to all of Egypt and be loved and understood. Dying, he repeats, dying. To say something twice is already to begin a poem, because in a poem, nothing is only itself, and everything implies everything else. If it were sufficient to call a thing by its name just once, in order to say all that it is, or all that one may have in one's heart, then perhaps there could be no poetry. I am dying, Egypt. That is, I have killed myself out of love for you. And again, dying. That is, it is nothing I can draw back from now. It is fully real that I will soon cease to be real. And perhaps he is asking himself and his love how something that seemed so full of strength and new possibility has now become inescapable death. The poetry of the drama perhaps plays with incommensurability here. The lines are spoken as Cleopatra and her two women servants are hoisting Mark Antony in his armor up to the window of their tower. They have a rope and a pulley. He is almost immovable and will very soon be unreachably far away among the dead. And yet he and they are asserting the greatest nearness between him and Cleopatra that these great lovers have ever felt. Two are becoming one, like parallels as they near the vanishing point. If the question of whether it can be numbered does occur to us about the golden rectangle, I think Euclid supposes that we ourselves may be able to supply the surprising answer in the negative with only a little reasoning. It is unfortunately not the kind of reasoning I am confident will succeed in this lecture. I've tried several times to write out a brief and perfectly clear account that shows the two pieces of the golden section have no common measure. But without the assurance that audience members could be free to pause the lecture and ask a question wherever something is not making sense to them, I have felt that my attempts have failed. There may be an unexpected commonality between Plato and Euclid in that the real life of both authors' work only manifests itself fully in conversation and in deeds. I will include my proof that the golden section makes two lines that have no common measure in the written text of this talk, which will be available through the dean's office, and maybe another short proof that the diagonal of a square has no common measure with its side will somehow squeeze itself in to this lecture. Neither is terribly difficult to follow. Even one of them might still take up too much of our time together today. For now, I ask you to grant me that both these things are provable. Perhaps the beauty people say is to be found in the golden section and made visible in the dimensions of the Parthenon and of numerous ancient Greek sculptures and vases and even vase paintings would be a kind of opposite to the beauty of the octave. That 2-to-1 ratio is commensurability at its clearest and simplest, expressed in the very smallest numbers, while the golden section is a ratio we cannot express, but only approach in even the very largest numbers. Yet it too has a kind of sublime geometric simplicity. A line has been divided in two pieces so that two areas made by a square on one piece and a rectangle on the whole line with the other piece are equal areas. In the language of ratios, which the freshman will learn very soon, the smaller piece of the section has to the larger piece the same ratio as the larger piece does to the whole. In that same language, the side of a square equal to a unit will have the same ratio to the diagonal of that square as the diagonal has to two of those units. We'll return in a moment to the square and its diagonal. Measure and counting. It was one of the complaints of the traditional moralists of Athens that Socrates was a sophist, a teacher of slippery arguments by which to win debates in courtrooms or public assemblies, and that he could make the weaker argument look like the stronger, that he could make you think that day was night or even was odd. These were some of the accusations brought against him in the trial that led to his death. When Meno's slave has seen that doubling the side of a square has not given us the length to produce a double square, but rather has produced a quadruple, Socrates innocently asks him to say exactly how long the line would need to be to give us a double of the original square, or just to point to it if he prefers. Maybe Mr. Sterling could show the two diagrams from the book that I sent along as an insert now. I don't know if that's easy for him to do. Yeah, there. So there we see the square on AD, which is four small squares. And when Meno's slave says, well, we could get a double square if we doubled the line, we extend that line to AK and soon see that we have given ourselves a quadruple. A quadruple square. Now, if we look at the other of those diagrams, we can see a diagonal. Socrates must have a diagonal in front of him in the diagram that he has made in the sand for himself and Meno's slave, because he says, just point to it if you can't name it. And so I think that line BD, at any rate, must already exist. And it's not clear in the directions that Socrates gives for drawing what he's drawing, that there are yet diagonals in this picture. But I don't actually know how else he would find the midpoint that he would be drawing those dotted lines through without drawing a couple of intersecting diagonals. So that's the moment I'm thinking about when Socrates says, if you can't tell us how much longer we would need to make that original line to get a double square, you could point to it. But the slave does not know to point to the diagonal at that point. There's no other line in the diagram than that one that would be useful to point to. Okay, so that's enough of those diagrams. Plato is well aware there will be no possible naming of the size in any units that also measure the side of the square, and yet that it is very easy to draw a line, the diagonal of the original square, and then to point to it as the right size for the size of a double square. But the side and the diagonal are incommensurable. I guess I will yield again to temptation and make a last hasty try at showing this in as few sentences as possible. Incommensurability is not something that shows up in a diagram. And so the diagram I show you will not, in that sense, be all that dramatic or useful. It's just to sort of give you something to think about while I talk you through the rest of the proof, which is a kind of a numerical proof. If you don't follow it now, don't fret. Find someone who claims to have followed it and have them show you what that showing is that I'm going to try now. If Mr. Sterling would show us that scrawled out proof which I sent to him. This is, if you want to have a whole proof in words, you could take a screenshot of this. It too can be included with a written copy of the text. Euclid 147, which shows that the square on the hypotenuse of a right triangle is equal in area to the sum of the squares of the other two sides, can be applied to an isosceles right triangle that is half of a square. I'll just read the proof as I have written it on this piece of paper. That might be easier for us all. So there's the upper diagram shows a half of a square, which makes an isosceles right triangle, square ABC. The right angle BAC is a right, the angle BAC is a right angle. Line AB equals line AC, and the square on AB plus the square on AC will equal the square on CB. That's the result of 147. Or we could express it two times the square on AB equals the square on CB. So I'll just read through this. Suppose AB and CB have a common measure. Then some measure some number of that measure makes length AB, and some other number of it makes CB. The square on AB will have an area of square units equal to the number that makes its length times itself. If the measure should fit three times into AB, the square would look like this one. I have square A smudge B. Whatever number of square units the square on AB contains, the square on BC contains twice that many. So that square, the square on BC, has an even number of square units. In this case, we would suppose that the square on BC has 18 square units as being the sum of those two other squares. But its length, the length of BC, must then be an even number of our hypothetical common measure units, because an odd number multiplied by itself only makes an odd number. So whatever that length BC is, BC times BC must make some even number. We can't come up with a whole number which multiplied by itself makes 18, but maybe that just means we don't have the right size triangle to show how a right triangle with equal sides can have a commensurable length between its, you know, that can have its side and its diagonal share a common measure. So let us suppose our common measure is the largest possible unit that measures both lines. We want to be expressing their relation in the smallest numbers we can, not, for example, 42 to 26, but 21 to 13. You know you have the simplest expression of the two numbers. You know you have the simplest expression if the two numbers have no common factor, or both of them must be odd. So it's also possible that one could be even and one could be odd. Since the diagonal is inescapably even, then the sides length measured by our hypothetical largest common measure must be odd. It looked like I didn't say that quite right. I have to look at my own copy here at home, how I wrote that. But I meant to say, as in the case of, say, 10 to 5, one number can be even and one can be odd. Now, 10 to 5, I guess, will reduce to 2 to 1. Well, yeah, in any case, In their case, when they are in their simplest expression, one will be even and one will be odd, or both will be odd. But we know that the square on the hypotenuse is even, so that means the lines AB and AC must be measured by an odd number. But for equally compelling reasons, the length of the side must be even. For if the length of the diagonal must be even, then it is equal to 2 times some number. Call that number n. So BC equals 2 times n. When that number is multiplied by itself to give us the square on BC, we have 2 times n times 2 times n, or 4 times n times n, just as 2 times 5 times 2 times 5 is the same thing as 4 times 25, that is 100. So the square on BC equals 4 times n times n. But since this is twice the square on a side, then each of them must be 2 times n times n, hence twice whatever number n times n may be, hence even. So if the side and the diagonal have a common measure, then the side must be both even and odd, or must be both an even and an odd number of that common unit. Well, so much for that proof. Something happens to a mind that has begun to follow geometrical demonstrations, something that looks like a choice as it regards the truths of different realms. Maybe it shows itself most clearly in the response to the absurdity that results when the square and the diagonal are assumed to have a common measure. It does not look like peace of mind. The imagination presses to remind us that we may divide the side or the diagonal as finely as we like, and insinuates that anyone with sense would see that somewhere in the realm of the very small, there is bound to be a piece so small as to measure whatever other piece from wherever else we might assign it to. The reason insists that no possible common measure can be found, which does not involve the result that an even number must also be odd. Aristotle memorably points out that as to the role of wonder in philosophy, although Socrates may say philosophy begins in wonder, we can see how in some cases wonder must give way to a kind of familiarity, and that what would now really produce wonder would be a demonstration that diagonal and side were, after all, commensurable. More wonder would be there than in the known outcome, namely that they are not and never can be. But I am afraid that the original wonder has not ceased to work on me, and even some familiarity with the proofs has not driven away a sense of aporia about their result. There is an ancient tradition that the Pythagoreans had agreed to keep the matter a secret from the non-mathematical public, and that someone who had sought to reveal it had been drowned in a shipwreck. Is the incommensurability that lurks so near the beginning of geometry really just something to get over? Would that make it like the contemporaneous horrifying discovery that lies could prevail over the truth among the audience of a fair and open discussion? Day can be made to seem night. One must still make up one's own mind if that discovery means no persuasion by words is ever to be trusted, or if something like truth can somehow still be approached. That is the choice I am thinking of. If, as I am suggesting, Euclid well knows the problem of incommensurability and even expects his more discerning readers to perceive it very early in his book, then we see it has not discouraged him. Is there a common unit that measures both our thoughts and the world? Let us return to this matter of measuring in its primal form of counting. When we count, we could be said to measure the how much of something in units. We want to know how big our herd is today, perhaps to see if any lambs were carried off in the night. And we lay down a kind of measuring stick called one sheep next to the herd and see how many we can find in it. The unit, one sheep, is not exactly like a fixed length. It may match a small lamb in one instance, a large ram in the next. They are equally sheep, and there are two of them. Cattle ranchers talk about how many head of cattle are on their ranch, so that the head has become the unit, since cows, bulls, and calves each agree in having one head, and so can be counted quickly by counting heads. Each particular sheep's head is not exactly like any other, any more than each sheep was. A unit, as Euclid will say in Book 7, is that by which each thing is called one. Actual unity is like perfect doubleness, not a thing one finds in one's hands, although hands may seem quite a good example of the double, but it is a way of seeing with the mind's eye and of talking. Things appear to come in kinds. A kind is a natural unity. It may not be saying too much to say that different kinds must always be somewhat incommensurable. Money is a fiction that lets us pretend that 3 days of the labor and materials and skills of shoemaking could be equal to 1 day of the labor and material and skills of house building. Euclid says that ratios can exist among things of the same kind, and that things are of the same kind which can by multiplication exceed one another. No number of houses can exceed a shoe, or even equal one, whatever Mother Goose may say. It is, as we say, like comparing apples to oranges. What lets us count heads or noses or whole sheep of different ages and sizes or all the different objects in a room without difficulty is the notion of the pure unit, the oneness that any thinkable, nameable thing must have to be a thing at all. Things that are generally or generically of the same kind can be counted by reference to ones that are all exactly the same as each other. Different assemblages of these ones are the different whole numbers. Each such assemblage has, in addition to its component units, a single unity peculiar to itself. Three is one number and is different from all others. It is not possible even to be as a multiplicity without at the same time being a kind of one. That appearance of things coming in kinds and our capacity to see it grounds most of how and what we think. When we recognize something at all, we are finding it to be a part of some whole. When we encounter something that seems especially unified, that brings together many parts in many ways to make a one, we feel delight. We call it beautiful, whether it be a painting or a melody or a story or a face or a sunset. We locate unities within larger unities: person, family, city, nation, cosmos. When we meet something that strongly resembles something of a different kind in some respect, we delight to bring the two together in our speech. We call it making a metaphor. All flesh is grass. Is it a stretch to describe this behavior as a kind of counting or measuring? It seems to have little to do with the measuring about which Nietzsche complains. That, he says, is a devaluing of the only world we have by the invention of another supposedly better world somewhere else, whose beings we claim to glimpse, and by which we judge our world and find it wanting. This measuring that lets us see how flesh is grass is no slander on flesh or grass, but a primary encounter with both. People sometimes express disappointment that the earliest ancient examples of writing, the wedge-shaped marks in tablets of clay that were baked or dried in Mesopotamia many thousands of years ago, seem to be restricted to inventories, mere lists of things or quantities of grain. But counting or measuring in a primal sense is the essence of our grasp on the world, at least as that grasp is found in language itself. We need not shy from calling those lists the first written poetry. The transition from listing names, that is units, and numbers of things to writing poetry seems a very slight transition indeed compared with the transition from an unbroken sequence of immediate stimulus reactions to names and numbers of things at all. Indeed, ancient poets as well as modern ones are notoriously fond of lists as such. Homer gives us the catalog of ships. The Hebrew scriptures list who begat whom, and both are masters of metaphor and measure. Homer speaks unforgettably of the sword or spear blade cutting flesh as pitiless bronze. If we are not explicitly measuring by unities or counting, giving an account, as we say, we are measuring still. Saul was by head and shoulders the tallest among the men of Israel. Thomas Hobbes says in Leviathan that all thinking is counting and computation, adding and subtracting. It is a surprising agreement from him with the Platonic insight that our capacity to see unity is what makes us human. And somehow we can also see what refuses to be measured, that is, that accepts no units, as well as all those things we count. In incommensurability, we seem to have found a thing we cannot imagine, but must nevertheless think as true. This is already remarkable and may encourage us to be more careful in distinguishing the imaginable from the true in other cases. The imagination is not a perfectly reliable guide, even to the possible, let alone to the true. Is it the infinite divisibility of the line that leads our imagination and our reason in opposite directions? Perhaps we can know some things to be true regarding what is infinite without being able to imagine them. Moses Maimonides points out that Apollonius proves a curved asymptote approaches a limiting straight line so that the distance between them is forever diminishing without limit and yet without ever entirely disappearing. they can get infinitely nearer forever without meeting. Maimonides says that we cannot imagine this, but that we can know it. Even to look down railroad tracks includes imagining. We see that they meet at the distance of the vanishing point. We may get so used to knowing something that we think we are successfully imagining it, or we may decide to discard our imaginations as any help at all to knowing, but both alternatives are likely to be mistaken. What about the wider implications of incommensurability? There are many. One seems to be a fundamental distinction between the continuous and the discrete, two different kinds of magnitude, represented in our thinking here by lines, which are continuous, and by numbers, which are assemblages of discrete units. Of course, a line may be divided into as many equal parts or artificial units as we like, or as few as two. So it is not in every way unavailable to the language of number, but it has no natural unit and can be thought of apart from the notion of an assemblage of units. It may be this absence of natural units that is at the heart of incommensurability. When we want to measure distances in the physical world, we begin by inventing a unit like the inch, roughly the top joint of a king's thumb. Everything that has a length must thereafter submit to being so many thumb joints long. Socrates and Meno talk about the lines in their example as being so many feet long. But that original thumb joint or foot reveals its peculiarity when we ask how we would measure its length. Strictly speaking, it has none, since there is no agreed upon unit by which we would measure it. It is one unit long. How big that unit is cannot be determined. Would we say one is one? Calling one a number might be like claiming to know how long an inch is. One only works for us as a measure in multitudes of itself. If we really want to say anything satisfying about how long an inch is, we must invent a centimeter and say it is 2.5 of them. But then we cannot say what the absolute length of the centimeter is. So we do make a multiple thing number out of things, units, each of which contains no multiplicity. The one is incommensurable with the numbers of things it counts. Socrates, on the day of his death, says that he gave up the study of natural science when he realized he still did not understand how one and one made two. We might remind ourselves that although lines are limited or determined by points, they are not made of them. Wherever there can be two points, we can think of a line that joins them. But since the line can always be divided, then there is always another point between any two. So that if a line were made of points, it would have as many as we like, and we could add as many more without expecting it to change in length. That is not the way a wall is made of bricks, at the very least. Is it the way a brick is made of clay? Let me offer another image of a kind of incommensurability. Can there be untranslatable words? What do we mean when we say that a particular word, say of Greek or French, really has no equivalent in English? We might like to say that such a word in its own language brings together, as parts of the same whole, several different thoughts or meanings which nowhere exist together in any single word of English. We can still list those meanings and instruct the learner to think them together, and we may have the learner's experience of beginning to feel as if, after all, the different meanings do deserve to have their own single word to unite in. We may start to think that deinos, the ancient Greek root of our word dinosaur, doesn't have to be heard as terrible, but possibly also in other cases wondrous, and in yet others clever and effective. We begin to hear in, say, the sentence, Socrates is said to be deinos at speaking, terrible and wondrous, clever and effective, all at once, in a way not really captured by our own recent and overused awesome. But perhaps our minds have jumped a gap or a discontinuity between Greek and English, rather than finding a common unit of measure. Perhaps we are briefly thinking in Greek. Hard to know. Perhaps all foreign words are, strictly speaking, not incomprehensible, but yet never perfectly translatable. I should address a doubt. What shall we say to someone who tells us we are making mountains of molehills, and that there is no real problem with translation, or even with expressing the diagonal in terms of the side? The doubter will say that if the side is called one, then the diagonal may be called the square root of two, or that number which, when multiplied by itself, will give us an answer of two. We may ask if the doubter can tell us how many times we will be multiplying it by itself, and receive the somewhat mysterious reply, 1.4142 dot, 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 with the further explanation that the dots represent a continuing fraction that never actually ceases. We may feel as if something is peculiar about a number that can never finish being named. But any number ending with a finite fraction will, when multiplied by itself, give us an answer that is either bigger or smaller than two. Inventing a symbol that means find the number which, when multiplied by itself, gives the number under this sign, and calling that symbol a square root sign, does not guarantee that there is such a number corresponding to any number I put under the sign. For 49, we find 7, but for 2, we find 1.4142 dot, 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 and the dots go on forever. If this infinitely continuing fraction is our way of reconciling the continuous with the discrete, or letting the same number be even and odd, we may wonder what might be getting lost. Perhaps there are no two things so close that the mind cannot find a gap, nor so far apart that the mind cannot find a bridge. What about being and non-being, or life and death, or right and wrong? Are they each incommensurable with their other, once and for all? What is at stake for us when we try to know? Incommensurability and Meno. I want to turn now again to the Meno for some help with the question of how we might come to know that something is true, or of how we might learn. Why does Socrates use the example of proving something about the diagonal of a square when he wants to encourage Meno to suppose that it is possible to learn, and even perhaps to learn how to be good? My thoughts are not terribly well organized on this topic, but let us begin with some possible connections. Virtue is proposed to us in the Meno and elsewhere in the dialogues as having four parts: courage, moderation, justice, and wisdom. Sometimes it is suggested that none of these can be separated from the others, that courage without wisdom is mere rashness, or moderation without justice, mere cold selfishness, for example. They are compared to the parts of a face, unable to exist except altogether. Suppose we imagined them as a square, in which their equality and codependence might be imaged. Then when Socrates asks what unites them or plays the role of that by which each deserves to be called a virtue, we could imagine that he is asking if there is a single other line that touches each and all of them. That line could be a circle around or within the square, or it could be the diagonal. The diagonal is in the square, yet bigger than any of the lines whose particular arrangement makes the square. It turns out, and you may, as I have said, want to consult a written version of the lecture to see why this is so, it turns out that its precise size is not nameable or measurable in terms of the sides of the square. And yet it has a perfectly well-defined size. How did Socrates' and Meno's attempt to define and unify human excellence lead to a mathematical problem about incommensurability and disharmony? Meno offers a poet's words to define virtue. Quote, "Virtue is to rejoice at beautiful things and be capable." The reader may be intended to complete the thought with "be capable of beautiful things." Meno immediately paraphrases, "that the one with an appetite for beautiful things be capable to get." Be capable of getting. And the ensuing conversation focuses on that power to get the beautiful things, which Mino will explain include gold, silver, and political offices, other such goods. The suggestion that desire of what is good might only belong to some few excellent people, with the further proviso that the small group who do desire good things will contain a smaller group who are able to get those things for themselves. This suggestion is attacked by Socrates with the argument that nobody can wish for themselves to become worse than they are, or desire a thing they know will only harm them. So since all wish for what seems good, he proposes to Meno, the important difference among people must be to do with which ones have the power to get what they think is good. Socrates does not here suggest that a more important difference might lie in the question of what things are really good and what others only look good. Perhaps he's not surprised that the distinction between those who only think they know what is good and those who really do know is not a familiar one for Meno. Like most of us, Meno thinks it is easy to know what good things are. Meno thought it was also easy to imagine that some of the unhappy or the unlucky might actually want for themselves things they knew were bad for them. Socrates must carefully remind him what would really be involved in wishing to harm oneself without any counterbalancing benefit of any kind, namely a kind of absurdity or impossibility. And then Meno admits that we all suppose we are choosing what is best, so that everyone can be said to desire fine things, at least if we will allow them the right to substitute desiring what seem to be fine things for desiring what are actually fine things. This equality in desiring apparent goods leaves the struggle for excellence to be, as we mentioned earlier, a matter decided according to who has the power to get or get at those apparent goods, gold and silver and honors and powers and offices in the city. Meno uses the verb poritsestai, or to achieve, to procure or make progress, as the third infinitive we translated in the phrase to desire fine things and be able to get them, poritsetai. Poros, the noun in that verb, is cognate with the English word ford, as in you can cross the river at the ford. A poros in Greek may refer to any number of stratagems or devices for accomplishing one's goals. It is a word whose privative form aporia has great resonances with incommensurability. Aporia is the condition of being without resources in the face of something. It can describe simple lack of money or that more general difficulty that we describe as feeling completely at a loss. It is how Meno feels when stung by the torpedo fish Socrates. We are at an impasse and can see no way across some barrier. Here we are near to incommensurability. Meno first uses aporia in the dialogue to say that when one knows the different virtues appropriate to old and young, men and women, slave and free, one will never be in any aporia about saying what virtue is. The simple connection of poros, resource, to money, let Socrates remind Meno that for all the importance of poritsesthai, or being able to get for oneself those fine things that virtuous people want, and for all the ways that enough money lets you have access to nearly anything you might want, there could be situations in which not poros, resource, is crucial to virtue, but precisely aporia, resourcelessness. If the only money to be had in a certain situation was money unjustly acquired, then Meno agrees that an aporia of money would then be virtue. One might go another step and say that if the only action that could be taken in a particular situation had to be action taken in complete ignorance of what a truly just outcome would look like, then inaction would perhaps be preferable. Meno turns out to be more familiar with aporia, at least in thought, than one might suspect of a very ambitious and not very scrupulous young aristocrat. The things he thinks about are strongly marked by the possibility of aporia. What kind of thinking does he like? He says he likes the way his teacher Gorgias explains the functioning of the body's senses by reference to effluences or outflows from the objects sensed, which outflows can be compared to very small shapes constantly crossing the space between, say, a sweet-smelling flower and my nose. If the tiny shapes fit the pores of my nose, then I will sense aroma. Other shapes, for example, those conveying sounds, will not fit my smelling pores, but instead will find paths through my ears and I will hear things. Socrates' Gorgian example ends with him noting that this mode of explanation can be adapted to all of the senses and perhaps many other questions as well. Maybe it explains too much. The question of commensurability is very prominent. Socrates says the little shapes are symmetroi with the pores of their proper sense organs. That is, they have a common measure. But smells are incommensurable with ears. To survey the microscopic world for a moment through this lens, we must be ready to see a constant flow of all kinds of possible sensations. Tiny shapes crossing one another's paths in all directions and bouncing away from doorways not designed to let them in, or slipping neatly into passages through which they fit as smoothly as an old key. A simple test is always automatically going on. Are you the right shape to pass? Is asked and answered thousands of times per second. Socrates describes Meno's pleasure in this explanation as a response to the high tragic manner in which he says this account appears. High tragic manner? What is that likely to mean? Does Meno, whose father knew and aided Xerxes, the tragic hero of Herodotus's history, does Meno have reason to wish for a world built on tragedy? If he wants to be excellent, to win praise for his power and fine possessions, to be honored as a Homeric hero is honored, is it more comfortable than facing the impasse of his actual knowledge or ignorance of his own powers to just think that the best warriors are the right shape from birth, and that if he is fated to be great, he will find a fitting passage? If he is already among the leading families of Thessaly, then his fate is clearly calling him. And if his father narrowly missed becoming a Persian satrap over some of Greece, maybe that has been saved for him. Those who treasure power above all things will recognize him, because it takes one to know one, and they will recruit him. He and they will be ready to betray each other if that is the path to greater power, but meanwhile they are commensurable and they both need allies. Another piece of thinking Meno likes is the argument that you cannot usefully seek to learn anything because either you know or you don't know. And so you cannot learn what you already know, but you cannot even recognize what you do not know. So await your fate in the confidence that you already have the right stuff. It's all or nothing at all. The tragic flavor is a flattering spice that suggests the great human beings must be prepared to do and to suffer things perhaps not bearable for ordinary humans, and that this is why we remember them and follow them and tell their stories. Amid the chaos, some shapes are arriving where they fit. Praise and blame may be beside the point. The importance of well-directed effort or the possible guidance of insight look like idealistic distractions on a stage full of opportunities for immediate deployment of strategies. Cast what grappling hooks you have in all directions and pull in the biggest fish you snag. Plato is showing us a young Meno shortly before he seized what must have seemed the perfect opportunity, an expedition led by the younger brother of the great king of Persia, intending to take the throne from his incompetent elder. Xenophon, a contemporary of Plato and like him a student of Socrates, has written in his book, The March Back, of Meno's corrupt and violent attempt to become a satrap in the Persian style and of the awful fate it led him to. We may imagine that Xenophon's report was known to Plato's first readers. That this young Meno is shown even wanting to talk about how virtue is to be gotten and kept is a positive sign that he doesn't yet simply suppose his job is to grab every gift of nature or fortune that comes in his reach. He somehow is open to the thought that he might need to do something else for himself, maybe improve himself somehow, and that Socrates could help him. But the tragic element perhaps overwhelms him. That tragedy is built on the foundation of incommensurability, the incommensurability of gods and humans. That may be what will keep Meno safe from the danger of being truly changed by his talk with Socrates. Tragedy for Mino may be about the near miss when a mortal comes along who could almost be mistaken for an immortal. There is no room on earth for humans who do not die. The great human beings who nevertheless do not yield or resign themselves to being less than the gods will be wonders in their lifetimes and will be long remembered after their deaths. The shape that is our lot may limit us to either having what it takes or not, but a certain kind of defiance of fate is possible. The very thing that seeks to diminish us, our mortality, can be embraced by the tragic protagonist and can transform us. The insistence by the tragic character that she alone will define herself, even if it should cost her life, nearly makes her into a god, and it simultaneously kills her. So this is what Mino must love, more than he loves learning, in the answers of Gorgias. It is striking how Gorgias's science anticipates our own. Our biology is still deep in the process of describing the docking of different tiny chemical particles and molecules in an elaborate process of sending and receiving signals and instructions according to what shapes fit what receptors. And still more striking what a difference remains between the recognition that a token fits a slot and the experience of understanding a thought. How welcome a kind of incommensurability might be to us if it guarantees our equality. Beyond any property I might own, I own myself as an insoluble mystery, which may decline to be judged by any other standard than its own. If our dignity is our irreducible otherness from all others, then most of our moral experiences will be determined by ways we do not fit in. The simple incongruity of having no common measure with others can stand for an inalienable freedom and an infinite value. But how do we know we are not flattering ourselves in the high tragic manner? These are only speculations about Mino and about ourselves. Without them, I would not know how to begin reading Plato. The aporia which Mino will use to characterize Socrates the torpedo fish has its counterpart in the Gorgian theory of everything, in the word aporoe, or effluence, outflow. Everything is only connected to everything else by this constant outflow or stream of shapes by which each thing shares its visible, audible, smellable, tastable, touchable, knowable self with the various human organs of perception, which happen to be commensurate with it. One wonders where the inexhaustible source for such constant outflow can be located and why it never runs low. One may also wonder if all that seeming incommensurability conceals a suppression of genuine differences of kind in things. Have we really seen very deeply or heard any divine harmonies when we assert that sight and hearing are at bottom both the same, just matter in motion? If it is possible, on the other hand, to learn in some un-Gorgian way by experience that knowable things are not inert possessions, but after all, have a kind of life, then knowing must be different from simple possession of property, which one can do while sleeping. Knowing must be an active practice, and one must be seeking to take on some of the life of what one wants to know. All nature, as Socrates suggests, must be akin for learning to be possible. However true it may be that each being must somehow differ from all others, that no two snowflakes or leaves are ever identical, it is still finally commensurability that we seek. That the example chosen to give us hope about our capacity to learn is the diagonal of the square, whose ratio to its side is not expressible in common units, must be especially important. What may it mean? It seems to say that there is more than one kind of intelligibility. The lack of a common length measure for diagonal and side does not preclude knowing things about the diagonal and its relation to that side. The counting of discrete units is not the only path to knowledge. The discovery of the line that will let us double the square depends on seeing more than what is there. We must begin to see areas, two-dimensional beings, in order to address a question about finding one dimension, the length of a line. The diagonal is not in the end confoundingly hard to know. It is the side of a square, twice as big as the one whose diagonal it is. If it is to be successfully measured, we simply refer to a second dimension, not to a line, but to an area. The Greek language uses the word dunamis, or power, in geometrical contexts, somewhat as we might use squared, or to the second power in English. A line may be said in Greek to be equal dunamē, the dative form of dunamis, or by means of power, in power, to some area, meaning that the square on that line is equal to the area in question. The diagonal can be said in Greek to be in power, the double of the square it divides. The echo of Meno's word for his ideal of the raw power of the tyrant, who can grab whatever he wants and hold it, is not accidental. But what is echoing what? The suggestion that the diagonal is knowable by its power to become a double square is a rich one. It makes us wonder if virtue itself has a kind of life in it, since living things are partly known by their power to duplicate themselves, to grow or reproduce. Does the recognition of virtue necessarily involve a beginning of reproducing it, or a desire to see it exercise its power? When we encounter someone good, we are in fact moved to imitation. Virtue would then be essentially active. It would be what it can become, rather than a simple inert quantity. This could be connected to the difficulty in saying what exactly it is, or even in describing it. A contemporary philosopher, Martha Nussbaum, has written a book called The Fragility of Goodness, but perhaps another could be written on the power of goodness. What if the more knowable a thing were, the more beautiful and alive it were? Would the most unified and beautiful of all naturally generate an entire world as a kind of octave of itself? We might then expect the nearness of such a thing to possess active power, to contain a kind of life that sustains and increases itself. Knowing would not then mean to behold something over there in calm clarity, while deciding whether to take it or leave it. It would be to feel the effect of the nearness of life, to be drawn to imitate and be informed by order and pattern, so as to become more nearly unified oneself and more aware of the unity of the world. Would such an experience make us suppose that delight in beautiful speeches could have the power to bring about beautiful deeds? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Stickney. We'll take a break of just a couple of minutes, if that sounds good to you, Mr. Stickney, and then we'll come back for the question period. And we hope many of you all will join us, and we'll go over how you can ask a question when we come back. So just a couple of minutes. Thank you so much. As we begin to transition into the question period, maybe I'll just mention, I said at the beginning that as much as we'd like to be together in the Great Hall, it does allow us to connect in different ways in this way. And we do see that we have students, faculty, staff from both of our campuses and from places further afield all joining us today. And that we find that a warming and comforting consolation for our dispersal. Mr. Stickney, do you feel ready to?
I'm ready.
coffee sure. And cookies is a bit more abbreviated here. So for those of you in the audience, you have a Q&A function, and you can type questions there, either attached to your name or anonymously. You also should have a button you can wake up at the bottom of your screen to raise your hand. And that would allow us to turn on your microphone, and you could ask a question live voice. So we'll take questions either way, and we'll sort of go back and forth and try to get through as much as we can in a reasonable time. So please, if there's a question or comment on your mind, we invite it now.
Someone has raised a hand.
So I see Mr. Howard Fisher has his hand raised, so give us just a moment, Mr. Fisher. You should be able to talk now.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Stickney. It's a lovely talk. I find it pleasant to contemplate that the proof of incommensurability has at its heart a contradiction, that is to say, an aporia. Does that seem to be a central element in your thinking?
Yeah, I think that's right. And that there's a kind of, I keep returning to it in some way, that Aristotle's joke doesn't comfort me. That is, I still think to myself, it the proof is undeniable, and yet I can't quite believe I couldn't find a piece small enough to serve as a measure. And that, I guess I do like that. That if I were presented as the alternative with a world in which nothing was understood to be finally resistant in any way to our reasonings, but everything either had yielded up all its secrets or was known to be about to do so, I think that would be a depressing place to live in. I want some kind of otherness in the things of the world that keeps them their own.
Well, if that's so, then thinking about your mention of Dedekind at the beginning, do you look on Dedekind's world as that gray and unhappy world that you seem to describe?
Well, yeah, it's funny that he has found a way to make the real numbers all of the same kind, so that pi and the square root of 2 are just as much numbers as 1 and 2, or as 2 and 3, I should say. I feel that something is being elided there. And yet, I can't deny that he sets some doubts at rest, and he makes it possible to go forward with a more rigorous understanding of number. I can't really wish that Dedekind had not come to be. But it's a problem for me about Dedekind. In some ways, I remain a little disappointed with the world he gives us, and that the notion of incommensurability has, in a certain way, seemed to vanish some time before Dedekind arrives on the scene. It's to his credit, I think, that he realizes it is still a problem and needs to be addressed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fisher. We have a written question from Peter Bellot. Did the slave boy remember, quote unquote, recollect maybe, that the diagonal is the key to doubling the area, or intuit it some other way? Did the slave boy remember that the diagonal is the key to the doubling the area, with remembering quotes, or intuit it some other way? Thank you, Mr. Bellot.
I think the way it's presented is that Socrates shows him the line and shows him how it will do the job that they want it to do, namely provide the side of a double square. And that, in Socrates' terms, the slave boy has recollected it when he sees that it is true. That is, he looks at it and sees that it works. And that's not a thing that he could do without a certain kind of grasp on things that is already his, even though he's never seen this line or been told that it's called the diagonal. He doesn't say, oh yes, I remember now, that's the diagonal. But he does see that it works, and he sees it in a way that seems in a way to deserve to be called a recognition. He recognizes that it's true, and that the re in recognize is the re in recollection. Is that helpful?
have to give Mr. Bellow a minute or two to let us know if it's helpful. Feel free to follow up in writing or by raising your hand.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I do see we have another hand raised, Barbara LaPala. And feel free to introduce yourself as well after I turn on the microphone. You should be able to talk.
Great. Thank you so much for your time today. I'm a first year student here. And I was just wondering what you thought. So you talked a lot about the role of imagination and kind of stitching this all together. But I was wondering what you think the role of intuition is in both the math you discussed, but also Plato's discussion of virtue. And if you think those are the same or if they're different, and if so, how?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that is a very interesting word, intuition. It seems to mean for us in our time, especially a kind of direct access to things in a way that we could not clearly explain. That if we know something by intuition, I think we mostly, I mean, you should correct me if I'm wrong, or fill out your notion of intuition if I'm not quite expressing it. But I'm supposing that what you mean by intuition starts at something like a strong or maybe undeniable sense that something is so, which we could not easily trace to a rational set of inferences or a logical sequence of thought. And, you know, so we're left thinking, well, maybe there's some other kind of access that we have to the world. And when Mr. Fisher was asking about the aporia in the proof of incommensurability, or the moment when you're finished with the proof and you still have a feeling that there's something you don't understand, or something you think is true has been shown not to be true, and you don't know how that is, it might be intuition that lets you enjoy that in a certain way. That is, maybe we have an intuition that all the time we are among things that do not exist simply for the sake of our understanding them, but that they have a real being of their own. But, you know, someone might say, well, how would you know that? All you can know about them are the things that you do know of them. And when you say there's more to them than that, what lets you know it? I guess that does seem mysterious to me. Maybe it comes first of all to us in our encounters with other people and looking into another human face. It seems sometimes possible to believe in the reality of that other person as fully as you believe in your own reality. But I'm not sure we manage to do that all the time. I think a lot of the time we merely line people up like getting our ducks in a row, and we know what we know about them enough to know what to say to them and what to do and how to get on in our day. But we don't stop and think the things that worry them absolutely as much as my worries worry me, or they are as important as I am. Their pains are as painful as my pains. We mostly, I think, don't quite exist on that level. And to exist on that level might take a kind of mysterious power that deserves to be called intuition. What do you think of when you hear that word?
Oh, I'm sorry, there's a plane going up above my house. but I think a lot of kind of the same thing that you described. So a way that there's almost a direct knowledge or a direct ability to access knowledge without maybe being able to fully flesh it out. But I wonder about the rhetorical corollaries of that, and that if and how that relates to the incommensurability that you described. And that, like, eventually is intuition, I guess, the unit that we can no longer fully break down, in the same way that you can't describe an inch in any other way besides an inch, unless then you go to centimeters, but then you just kind of follow that same line of reasoning.
You postponed the problem. Yeah. Yeah. That, it's very strange. I do think that it would be worth thinking harder about what intuition could mean and what might make it possible. It seems a little bit miraculous that there should be such a thing, and it's easy to say what it's not, but harder to say what it is. I guess we all find ourselves reaching for it as a category at various times. And so there must be some experience that we agree it corresponds to. But I wonder whether, how much agreement we might get among people about the kinds of things they feel they have intuitions of. It's interesting that it has that word tuition in it that makes one think of tutors and learning, and there's a kind of, maybe it is on some level the root of learning. The philosopher Kant, whom you read in the junior year, will use intuition to describe simply the things that come to us through our senses, because I think he sees us as so much a kind of prisoner of our own thinking and our own categories, and that the mere possibility of something turning up in our world unexpectedly looks to him like a kind of dramatic encounter. And maybe it is. I mean, maybe he's not wrong to say every sensation is actually an intuition. And it's the experience like a sensation of a certain kind of thought, that the spontaneity of it and undeniability of it that we are more accustomed to calling intuition nowadays, but we really should begin from the notion that sensations themselves are intuitions.
Thank you, Ms. LaPala. We have some questions stacking up. I think we'll take a written question from Mr. Keyes, and then Ms. Davis has raised her hand. I also noticed Mr. Below did write back and say recognize, which he hyphenated as recognize.
Yes.
Was helpful in your answer, Mr. Stickney. So Mr. Keyes asks, you said that the works of Plato and Euclid live, and he put that in quotes, live most in conversation about them. How do you understand commensurability in conversation itself, between the conversation and truth, between interlocutors?
Oh, that's a good question. I think those are both possible loci for incommensurability, and there are interesting moments in conversations when someone is trying to explain to another speaker and listener that he or she does not yet feel understood. That I think in speaking to one another, we paraphrase what we understand to be the other's thought. And sometimes one has the experience of paraphrasing several times and still hearing from the interlocutor, no, that's not what I mean. And there's a famous line in a poem of T.S. Eliot's in which he says, what if a woman at a cocktail party should say to you, no, that is not what I meant at all, not at all. He's sort of foreseeing a terrible and humiliating experience. That's one kind of incommensurability, which I think mostly at the college we strive hard to overcome. Maybe other times people give up in the face of that. After two or three times of of trying to say, well, do you mean this? No. Do you mean this? No. Can you tell me what you do mean? That's the moment, I guess, at which the rubber meets the road, when the person who feels misunderstood must try to find a way to speak it so as to be no longer misunderstood. And I have, I guess, almost an infinite faith that that is possible, that with imagination and maybe intuition on both sides, two people will be able to explain themselves to one another. But I think it's possible. One can certainly imagine a situation in which someone says, well, you did not grow up where I grew up, and so you will never understand really what I feel like when these subjects are discussed or what they mean to me. It seems to me, at the very least, the great writers manage to understand things from worlds in which they did not grow up, and to make them alive to us who did not grow up in those worlds either. But so that's incommensurability between speakers. Then the incommensurability between us and the truth may always be there with us, and all we can do is keep trying. But again, maybe that's what keeps our relation to the truth a living one, and not the relation of a property holder to property. Mino really seems to think that he can push his Gorgian answers across the table towards Socrates and say, have you got anything better? And if Socrates does, he'll pick that up and leave the table better equipped for his next debate with someone else. And so that's a kind of, there's no incommensurability for him there. He thinks he understands everything that he understands, and he's picking up the most useful things. So it's that, maybe it's the incommensurability between us and the things we try to understand that must remain if our understanding is to remain alive, some incommensurability.
I think we will take Ms. Davis's question, and then we have a written question from Mr. Vanderlift we'll go to after that. Ms. Davis.
Hi. Thank you, Carrie. I really enjoyed the lecture. I think that my question may be connected to the intuition question, but I was thinking about, you ended the talk by talking about two modes of knowledge, a kind of knowing by measurement or unit, and then what you were discussing throughout, the kind of a different kind of knowing of incommensurability by a kind of getting closer. And I guess sometimes when I'm thinking about incommensurability, there's this notion of standing in the face of something awesome, sort of the incomprehensible, the other as utterly other. And I'm wondering how that goes together with the notion of the second kind of knowing, in which we become close to, maybe imbibed with, and are able to reproduce and enact it. So really what I'm trying to get at is the kind of jaw-dropping, stop-in-your-tracks character of a sort of confrontation with incommensurability, and a kind of knowing that would allow for active, embodied reproducing of it. I sort of see a tension there, but I wanted to hear more about how you're putting those two together.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of encounter with that kind of incommensurability, I guess, is always marked by some fear, and some maybe often by a kind of reverence, that there must be something that keeps one in the neighborhood, you might say, at that moment, that if it were simply a threatening kind of otherness, whose very otherness seemed to raise the possibility of your own annihilation. I mean, that would be sort of maximum incommensurability, that you and this incommensurable being couldn't really occupy the same region at the same time, that that sense that no one can look on God and live, or something like that. And so if one does not simply flee that situation, or is not simply destroyed by it, which I think we might understand in some cases to be what happens to some people. I suppose maybe that some people who leap from a great height are, you know, have been overwhelmed by that very thing, that very experience, and they, in a way, wish to annihilate themselves rather than try to be there in that place at that time. But if you stay, it must be that you are still finding something in yourself that can withstand being there. And so you must be thinking that there must be a kind of underlying commensurability still. You must be thinking that there is actually room in the universe for me and it. Mm-hmm. But what happens after that, it seems to me, must be not a thing to be described in general terms. Or, it's a great question, and I do think it's. One that we have some things to help us think about it with, maybe most of all in the scriptures or the writings of mystics that we do read some of at the college. But yeah, it seems almost impossible to speak well about even what it would be that allows you to stay in the presence of the really sublime, if I can paraphrase it that way. Do you have more thoughts about it?
No, it's helpful. I think it's a real sort of standing question for me. I think maybe it comes up sometimes for us in discussions about the senior year, where clearly incommensurability is all over the program, but I don't know, there's some kind of, maybe at least for me, explicit moments where something like the world shattering in the face of standing in that kind of awe comes up. And I think we worry about that, about recovering meaning and action and, you know, sort of human life, a rich human life in the face of, you don't want to just end up sort of on the porch thinking, you know, in a state of aporia, connecting the living and being in the world with these sort of profound experiences. It's a living question for me. So
I think there's you know, in the fate of Isaac, who has seen his father ready to kill him and has understood that he has been spared somehow at the intercession of God, it's people point out that Isaac is never, never appears again in any scenes with Abraham. He seems in a certain way to spend much of the rest of his life recovering from that moment. He does, he digs up again some of the wells that his father had dug and that had been filled, I guess, either by malicious people or maybe that got filled up by accident. But he takes on some of his father's work in the figurative sense of reopening those wells, and he passes on a blessing. But there's a way in which he does look like someone who was nearly crushed by that kind of incommensurability. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's the best example I can propose. And one could try to think harder about the life of Isaac.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Davis. So I'll go ahead and read this question, Mr. Stickney. It's long, and I'm not going to highlight all the sort of scare quotes or quotes in it. Okay. Mr. Vanderluft, you suggest that something might be elided in Dedekind, perhaps otherness. And this seems right insofar as Dedekind seeks to make all the numbers completely comprehensible within his conceptual scheme. But I wonder if you might talk a little bit more about what is elided, particularly with regard to the loss of the unit, that in virtue of which anything is called one. To define numbers with cuts rather than as ones, what exactly is lost here? We encounter the beings in the world in the first place as ones, as individuals about which things can be said. What do we lose in jettisoning this perspective? What do we lose in taking ourselves to be capable of stipulatively constructing number and whatever else in any way we might choose?
Yeah. Oh, that's well asked. It does seem as though that simple and beautiful sense of the unit as naming a kind and counting and allowing us to count has been traded for this array in which things are perfectly well defined by their location among one another and by an understanding of continuity. And I guess, yeah, it does. Maybe if not altogether lost, at least put out of court for a while, is the sense that things can stand out by their own being alone. In Leibniz, one seems to get an account of the world in which everything might, on some strange level, only exist as the intersection of all the vectors of everything else, that there's really only a grand one, which if you look at it, can be, you know, if you sharpen the focus, it can be seen as a kind of infinite interweaving and overlapping of all these threads, but no thread has any being by itself. It is only what it is in the whole. And that sense that, maybe if one moves that into the political realm a little bit, that that is getting close to kind of saying no one has any inalienable rights. No one is a one all by himself or herself. We all are only reckonable as parts of the whole, and the whole is always, the whole must always come first. And I guess we're all sort of trained as North Americans to be suspicious of a holistic thinking that will leave us with no real independence at all. So it may be that the numbers, it's my worry that the numbers are going to reflect that back onto us in Dedekind. Yeah, there's probably more to say, but.
Well, it might be that the next question somehow continues the threads. If you want to circle back around, you can, but we'll go ahead and take the next question from Ellie Labs, if I'm saying that correctly. I'm wondering if incommensurability is simply a lack of a common unit, or if you think it stands for some greater form of misunderstanding. I'm thinking in particular of how Spinoza depicts the relationship between God and man, that man is of God's substance with his own particular attributes, modes, etc. In that case, it seems that the units of God and man are not necessarily incommensurable, but that man is finite and God is infinite. We do not know the commensurable proportions. Does that make this relation thus incommensurate? In more concise words, is not knowing the units for commensurability a kind of incommensurability, or is it a different kind of thing altogether?
Yeah, the Spinoza is a great example because he tells us that extension and thought are two modes, and that God may exist in many other modes that we have no notion of. And so there's a kind of incommensurability, a little bit like what Herman Melville is trying to persuade us exists between us and the whale in Moby Dick, that at one point in Moby Dick, he points out that the eyes of the whale are entirely separate. There are, you know, over 100 degrees between those two eyes. And so the whale must be able somehow to look at two utterly different things and think about them and know about them together at the same time. And Melville compares it to, he imagines seeing someone demonstrate two different propositions of Euclid on the blackboard, say one with his right hand and one with his left or something, that it's not a kind of thinking that we can imagine, really, to be tracking the world at the same time from two completely different places. And so that's, I guess, a kind of incommensurability that seems a little different from merely lacking a common unit. But Mac, lacking the common unit is a good image, maybe in some ways, even for that. I would like to think some more about that question, because I think that Spinoza wants us, in a way, to be utterly at home and content with our modes of thought and extension, and our place within the substance that is God. But on some other level, it seems to me we might find it odd to think that there's a great deal of God which we could never hope to understand, not even in an infinite time.
Okay, we have a lull. We can see if we get another question, another hand raised, or another written question.
Maybe we are thinking about our commensurability with supper. Is there one more?
There is. Yeah. There's at least one more. Miss Burke, who I was in a seminar with the other day. Miss Burke, I because of the version of Zoom you're using, I need to promote you to a panelist. So brace yourself or turn off your video. I think I'm bringing you aboard with us. We'll find out in just a moment.
I see a screen. Yeah, Ms. Burke Travis.
Oh, hello. How are you?
Hi.
I think that you'll be happier if I keep it without the video. I've been reading all day. Hello, Mr. Stickney. I don't expect you to recall who I am at all. I just want to, first of all, apologize for being such a stubborn former student of yours in the mid-90s, trying to, just really struggling with understanding Venus and her apparent motions. I just didn't get it. But oddly enough, with 25 years later, you know, we have all these apps that show the heavens and where the International Space Station, for instance, is located every minute of the day. And I am just so attached to it now, thanks to you and your pressure on me to redo my Venus paper 3 times. I can't thank you enough, honestly.
That's very kind.
No.
Very kind of you to recall that to me.
Oh, no, it's been in the back of my mind for a very long time. And I'm very blessed now that I'm a grad student after having raised 6 kids and trying to impart upon them all the wonderful things I've learned as an undergrad. But, you know, we're in Kierkegaard right now. And I have to, I was trying to compose an appropriate question, but I was struggling. Maybe you can help me with it. I was stuck on what you said about wonder must give way to a kind of familiar. And I'm wondering if there's some kind of connection or relationship to the concept of moment that Kierkegaard is talking about, where he says the moment in time must have a decisive significance so that it will never be able to forget in either time or eternity. And obviously I'm reading off the paper because there's no way I could remember that on my own. But I'm trying to just, because a wonder is like an emotion. So I'm wondering, things that matter to us, there, you never forget those moments. So I'm thinking commensurability, incommensurability, do these, you know, is there a connection or relation of some sort?
I think Kierkegaard is a wonderful author to bring into the conversation, because he's maybe the most explicitly interested in incommensurability after Plato and Euclid and Dedekind. Kierkegaard would have to be on the list. And the sense that it is the incommensurable that we need most, and you know, that you might say, his talk of the absurd, and adopting an old church father's formula, Tertullian, I think it is, who said, I believe because what I believe is absurd, that if it made sense, I wouldn't need to believe it. And right. So there's a strange way in which Kierkegaard is always pointing us to the kind of incommensurability of being finite creations in the presence of an infinite creator. Mm-hmm. And an infinite creator who is reaching out to us somehow. He didn't just sort of make us from his infinite distance and let us go on our merry way, but he has involved himself in our history. And the incommensurability of finding yourself somehow in the presence of this being who is both in time and in eternity at once, and not taking that to mean that what's happening to you in this moment is, after all, in the big picture, only one part of a guaranteed outcome or something like that, but that it's up to you what happens next in some way, that you have been invited into God's sculpting of history to sculpt yourself and your own life. And that, yeah, as you say, that things can happen one by one in time that have eternal significance, that you can in a moment of time be trying to commit yourself to an attitude about your own possible eternality. And so that we are in some way trying to overcome that incommensurability and be both in time and in eternity ourselves, seems like the very concern of Kierkegaard's and the nerve of what he's trying to think about.
Very good.
Yeah, that's very helpful that you brought him in.
Excellent. Well, there's joy in the journey, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time. Wonderful to see you. Thank you,
Sister. Great to hear from you.
Thank you. And I think we have
a
written question and a hand maybe from the same questioner. So I'm going to go ahead and call on, looks like Dennis Hoylman, if I'm saying that correctly. Are you there?
I'll say yes.
Mr. Hoylman?
What would you say the difference is, if any, between intuition and guessing?
Well, sometimes a guess is inspired and sometimes it's just a shot in the dark. And so, I mean, I think we make that distinction in various ways. We say this is just a wild guess, or this is a guess, but I can't get it out of my head. There are different ways that one might introduce a guess into a conversation. And in the one case, it might sound more like an appeal to intuition. I'm going back a little bit to that question about Kierkegaard, I'm struck that intuition might contain in it a certain appeal to what we call conscience, that there's something that we might say or do because, as we say, we could not live with ourselves if we did something else. And you might say that's an intuition, that we're sure we could not live with ourselves if we did other than or said other than we're now going to say or do. And at that point, guess wouldn't be the right word anymore. But I do think that in seminars, sometimes it's very helpful to tell people, give yourself more permission to guess. There may be things that you will land on if you let yourself guess that you would not if you strictly censored anything that was not a matter of conviction and conscience, mm-hmm. a personal certainty of some kind, or b, a well-reasoned connection of logical thoughts. But there has to be a room somewhere for guesses. And I think guesses can be wonderful things and expressions of imagination. Sometimes they light a fire in someone else's mind if you let yourself go ahead and make a guess. So yeah, they seem to belong somewhere in the same ballpark, but to have some differences.
Okay, that's a good point.
Well, Mr. Stickney, not that the fitting time of question periods is commensurate with the time of the clock, but I see we're about to swing past our second hour, and I wonder if I'd like to give you the chance to offer any closing words, but and then we'll stop. But just let me say, again, thank you so much for offering this for us today, and for others who will have a chance to listen to it and see it later. And I thank the audience. Quite a few of you have hung in there with us from all over, and that's really welcome. Mr. Stickney, I do see we got a question that came in here. Uh-huh. I will leave it to you whether you want to do something with this. We can also tell Mr. Ross that he we should reach out to you. What's your preference?
I'll take the question and then say a final thank you and goodbye.
Shall I go ahead and read it aloud so folks can hear it? Okay. This is from Alejandro Ross. I don't have much of a question, but a few times the claim, man is the measure of all things, has come to mind during your talk. Maybe when you mention someone's, I forget who, opposition to the made-up perfect world that distracts from the real world in front of us, or the first writings that were just lists of numbers of things leading into poetry. Do you have any thoughts about this? This man is the measure of all things.
Yeah, I think my primary thought maybe was that we might rush past the full richness of measuring too often, and we might be in a hurry to get beyond the way in which poetry is itself a kind of measuring, and that we've given measure a bad name in a certain way. Might have been part of the point of my lecture and exploring the ways in which measure is a deeper thing than we customarily think. I guess I'm still on the side of those who want to say man being the measure of all things seems to propose that things only have as much being as is convenient for us, and it impoverishes the world and impoverishes us. Mostly it's opponents of Socrates in the dialogues who propose that man is the measure of all things. And so I am suspicious of it, but maybe I helped myself in writing the lecture a little to understand the attraction of such a statement by thinking harder about all the things that measuring can be. And yeah, including that kind of transition from lists to poetry. So yeah, that's, I guess, most of what I have to say about that. But I did want to thank everyone who attended and who spoke and who listened, and apologize for the shortcomings of the lecture. It was in some ways kind of scattered, and in some ways it went on too long. But it did, it let me think about some things that I'm serious about, and I'm glad that you all could come and take it seriously too. I want to repeat what I said at the beginning, that I'm just so grateful to have had such a long and enjoyable association with the college, and that we are still who we are, and we are still doing very seriously what we do best. So thanks to you all, and especially to you, Mr. Dean, for that. And I wish you all a good evening. So now we press buttons and vanish like soap bubbles, I believe, is the way these Zoom meetings end.
You and I can stay on for a moment. A moment?
All right. We will bid farewell to the audience.
We have a couple of thanks coming into you there in the chat thread, I see.
Oh, that's nice.
Wow. So we'll let folks leave.
Am I looking at your wine cellar behind you, Michael?
No. I don't have a wine cellar.
There's something underneath that raven. There's a picture of a raven, and then there's a cupboard.
Okay, that's
my spice wall.
I've expelled all of the audience except for your lovely bride. So
that was great, Carrie. That was
thank you.
It was cosmic in a way. I mean, you touched on everything.
I tried perhaps too hard in that direction. As I listened to myself, I thought, you're going in too many different directions. That's the joke about the posse rode off in all directions. But
it was a great question period. It was, it all went really well.
Yeah.
Carrie, I was curious because I didn't know how you set it up. Did you scan the names in the audience?
No, I didn't. I should have pressed panelists or attendees.
Yeah, that's, I don't know if I was totally, well, you switch it from panelists to attendees. So you probably saw the number. I mean, it was really well attended. We had 60
65.
There, which we haven't done on a Wednesday, for anything like this. But it was also quite a group. Joe Sachs was there. Anita Kronsberg was there. Obviously, Howard, who asked a question. I saw Susu. I don't know if that was Susu or David. I saw Jacqueline Levine. I don't know if that was Jacqueline or David. A lot of students whose names I recognized. Allison Chapman, new tutor. I mean, there were others, but there. Trying to think if there's anybody else that stands out from Annapolis, but it was quite something to see Joe Sachs' name there and Anita's. Yeah. Charlie Thomas. Do you know Charlie?
No.
Okay, no. So she's a friend of mine who's she's an Emory philosophy PhD who's very involved with ACTC, does some Liberty Fund things. She runs a great books program at Mercer. And she was going to be one of our featured speakers at that conference. She was going to talk about the Hong Kong democracy movement. But anyway, she must have just seen it on my Facebook page because I posted it there.
I visited Mercer a few times back in the 90s. And so maybe we could have crossed paths then.
Yeah, it's possible. It's possible. Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, at a certain point I saw that I had gone maybe over an hour, and I looked and I saw the participants had dropped from 60 something to 50 something. And I thought, well, you deserve it. You should have kept it a little shorter. There's nothing to prevent me from editing it a little further before I give you the dean's office a written copy.
Well, I thought it was lovely, Carrie. And I think we should always be a little phantasmagoric and try to blow people's minds rather than scale it down. So.
All right.
That was so good. It was nice. It was nice to hear a question from. Do you know Michael, Miss LaPala?
No,
I don't. I immediately looked on my mug book to see who she was. I don't know her. So, but she's good.
Is she a freshman? She said it as a first year student, and it occurred to me she sounded like a freshman in a good way.
And is that home? It sounds like she's.
Presumably. With the plane going overhead, yes.
Santa Fe or Annapolis, I don't know.
Okay, and you see, you got a couple thank yous here. Andrew Dorchester and Magnolia Van Diver. Miss Burke, who asked that question, was I don't know. I wasn't sure if she. She was really an Annapolis student in the 90s. Uh-huh. I knew her in the mid 90s. But maybe she did 1 year out here because you weren't in Annapolis in that period.
Well, and I've never taught Ptolemy in Annapolis.
Okay, so that answers that.
Yeah.
But she's doing the LA here, and she's married to a Johnny, and I forget they've had a child, I think, go through the program.
Oh boy.
So anyway, she was in my I've seen her on campus. I think maybe for their child's graduation, but she was in my Louise Glick seminar on Friday, these sort of open seminars we did. She's so excited to be able to do this from home in a way she wouldn't be able to.
Well, it's always great to hear from an old student.
Yeah.
Especially if they're telling you you were right to insist on something. That's doubly rare.
Well, Carrie, I think you've more than earned your supper.
Well, thank you so much. And I might try to do this again. At one point, whenever you're doing a lecture, you think, okay, this is the last one. I'm never going to do this again. What made me think I could do this? But I might try again. It was fun.
Very good. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Be in touch soon.
Okay. Bye. All right. Bye-bye.
Yeah.